The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and is of the opinion of the hosts and guests only. This information should not be considered as investment advice. Hello, I'm Rob Friedman, and welcome to Team Talk. In this episode, we're talking with Roger Hewins on the topic of profitability. He posted a blog on our website called Profitability for Dummies. It really helped clarify a lot of the underlying factors that go into our investment philosophy. So I invite him on the show today to kind of walk through it and help us better understand all the things that go into building our portfolios. So one of the things I've always wondered about is, you know, when we say we have a portfolio that tilts towards X, what does that mean? What is that portfolio doing?
Well, the term tilt is as opposed to saying, you know, bet the ranch. For example, if cheap stocks outperform expensive stocks over time with a lot of variation along the way, if you're really a big risk taker and you want to bet the ranch and do nothing but value stocks, you're going to have quite a rough ride. You probably will come out ahead in the very long run, but meanwhile, you may take quite a pounding. If you have a balanced portfolio of growth and value that looks like the S&P 500 for your large stocks, a tilt means you just have a little extra value, not a huge amount extra. Because as the old saying about the market goes, you know, bulls make money and bears make money and pigs get slaughtered. You don't want to be a pig. Don't overdo it. Professionals don't overdo it. And a tilt is a description of a professional taking incremental risk of a particular kind in the portfolio without doing too much.
So when you look at the blog, Profitability for Dummies, you talk about our investment philosophy and the research behind that. Could you go into just a little bit about who the founders of this research are?
Well, it really started with David Booth.
That's right.
To the school that's now named for him, the Booth School of Business in Chicago. But at the time, he was a student of FAMA. And the small cap effect had been found, meaning the very smallest companies tended to have long-term outperformance compared to the broader market. That is, those thousands of tiny little companies as a group did better in the stock market than the S&P 500 with a lot of variation. So he left business school and founded a firm to capture that return by creating a fund at the time called the 9-10 fund for the 9th and 10th deciles of size in the New York Stock Exchange. Kind of technical. They changed it later to microcap, which is easy to understand. Very small companies. And I mean, all of them would be a tiny fraction of the size of Apple, for example. All of them put together. And he created a mutual fund because big institutional investors couldn't get invested in those thousands of small stocks because they were having to buy tiny little pieces, and it was just impractical. So we created a mutual fund, and they could just buy shares of that. That's how it started. 10 years later, FAMA French came out with value, meaning the cheapest stocks, the kind you'd shop for at Walmart, outperform the expensive stocks you buy at Nordstrom in the long run. And the smaller stocks were still outperforming the big stocks. Over shorter periods of time, anything could happen, lots of variations. But in the long run, 10, 20 years, your small stocks outperform the big ones, the value. Cheap stocks outperform the expensive growth stocks. And investing became all about having discipline, investing in the broad market in a diversified way, and having incremental extra amounts called tilts of value and small, instead of trying to do stock picking and market timing and all of that. And that's essentially the core of it.
So there are three factors that went in, and then you talk about the fourth factor that kind of spoiled
I only talked about two, value and size. Three is just considered overall exposure to stocks, the risk asset.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then fourth, later added, was profitability.
And that's the key one that...
that we wrote the article about.
Correct.
And profitability just refers to... the concept is some companies have core operations that are inherently more profitable than the core operations of other companies. And you'll have stocks that are priced reasonably close to each other, but one company is consistently more profitable. And why wouldn't that company be more valuable? And the answer is, it should be more valuable. So if you define value in simple terms, such as the price of a stock compared to the book value of a company, and all you would buy are cheap stocks, you would capture the value factor, but profitability adds an important wrinkle, a new dimension, which essentially says if companies are roughly comparable in other ways, like book value and stock price, if one company is more profitable than the other, and that profitability tends to be consistent, that's been established, it should be more valuable. So if their prices are close to each other, you want to buy the stock with higher profitability and not the one with lower profitability. So it's not as simple anymore as just looking at, is it cheap? Because some stocks are cheap and they represent a bargain. Some stocks are cheap
and for a reason. They're
going to get cheaper still.
Yeah.
You don't want those.
No.
And some are a little more expensive, but they're really good and they're worth it.
There's a lot of potential.
So profitability is telling you this stock is still priced cheaply based on its profitability. Its profitability is a lot better than this other stock, and therefore that justifies a higher price. So the fact that it has a slightly higher price and a higher valuation doesn't mean it's not a good value. And I always think of it in terms of height and weight. I'm going to favor people who weigh less than 150 pounds because I think they'll be healthier. You say, well, wait a minute. This person is 5 feet tall, and this person is 6 feet tall.
Which one's healthier?
6 feet, 150 pounds isn't much.
No.
5 feet, 150 is quite a bit. And that's like... that height is the profitability dimension.
Okay.
Or you can support more weight. When you have higher profits year after year, you can support a higher price and still have it be reasonable and worth investing in.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we started out buying nothing but less than 150 pounds with value. And now incorporating profitability, if you're 5 feet, you better weigh less than that or we don't consider you value. And if you're 6 feet tall, you can weigh 180 and you're still a value stock because you can support the weight. Your profitability can support a higher price and still represent a good buy.
So in the article, you talk about, and under the heading of the end of understanding and happiness, trading costs, momentum, and signals from securities lending. Can you explain these a little bit more and how they factor in?
Yeah. First of all, I've had the majority of my clients tell me they didn't want me to explain all of that. That they hired us because they understood enough about our investment philosophy to know it was good and to know that we were looking out for their best interest as fiduciaries. And they were glad that we were monitoring all these things. They didn't want to. Some clients have had enough interest to want to hear about it. And we're all excited to talk about it.
Yeah.
But like I said, a number of clients have made very clear they don't want to hear it. They call it techno babble and they don't want to hear it. But the things you mentioned, trading costs, for example.
Yeah.
Active managers with a lot of turnover will typically have high cost of trading. Aside from charging high fees because they have to have expensive people doing all that research to try to outguess the market, when they're buying and selling stocks, they're not only paying commissions on all that, but when they want to buy a stock, they want to get it now. And they pay a premium on the bid ask to get it now. And when they want to sell one, they want to sell it now, and they take a hit on price to move it now.
Okay.
An index fund generally doesn't trade very much. Just not trading very much keeps costs low. However, index funds have to reconfigure themselves. For example, the S&P, at least once a year, some stocks go in and others go out.
Right.
And some everybody knows exactly when those trades are going to happen. And so the stocks that get sold out of the S&P get sold cheaply. And the ones that get bought expensively. And it's not just the commissions, but the spread the brokerage community takes buying and selling with the index funds. So index funds actually have higher trading costs that you don't see and don't understand than you would think. At the other extreme, you have funds like the DFA funds, where they'll have a broad benchmark, but they don't adhere to it religiously in the sense that they have to have exactly the right number of shares of every specific stock. And by the way, on a certain Friday, they're going to trade a bunch of stock and everyone's going to know it and they're going to pay a lot to sell and buy. Quite the reverse. They have the option, for example, in small cap stocks where they hold thousands of shares to, first of all, hold the shares they have and not have to turn them over at all. But secondly, if someone goes to a broker, if, you know, an ERISA plan goes to, as a manager, goes to a broker and says, we need to sell out of this block of small shares. And that broker needs to find a place to sell it because he needs to find a buyer.
Need a buyer, yeah.
Well, he goes to DFA and says, would you like to buy this small stock? And from their perspective, they got thousands of these stocks, many billions of dollars in the portfolio. Any one transaction doesn't mean that much to them. So can we add that to our portfolio? Yes, of course we can. But we don't need to. And at a certain price, we're willing to buy it from you. Call that a discount.
Okay.
So their trading cost from the DFA, from the broker's perspective, selling stocks for his client, they incur a significant positive trading cost. From DFA's perspective, they have a negative trading cost. They bought that stock below its market price because it was valuable for that entity to be able to offload a whole block of it at once. And they were willing to take a discount. So DFA gets to buy stocks at a discount. And someone else says, I want to buy a certain small stock and I want to buy a significant amount quickly without destroying the market price for it. And I call DFA and say, I see you've got a bunch of this small stock. Would you like to sell it to us? Again, from their perspective, how much they hold of any one stock really isn't going to matter. So they're willing to sell it, but at a premium price. So again, they make money on the sale by selling that stock at above market price and the buyers paying a premium to get it. So DFA is one of the only investment firms I've seen that has on average negative trading costs. They make money with their trading because they don't have to sell and they don't have to buy. They can be patient. They can wait for their price. even when they have to add stocks to a portfolio, they'll have a long list of stocks, any of which will do, and they take their time and they wait until they get good pricing. And that turns out to be extra return that over time accumulates pretty significant.
Yeah, I mean, clearly patience is off.
Kind of a technical thing, and most clients really don't want to get too far into that. But I like it. I used to be involved in measuring it for institutions. I'm very familiar with it. Momentum is simple and hard to understand and explain. No one's really explained it. But bottom line is, certain stocks have prices that in certain periods of time tend to trend for a while.
Okay.
Theoretically, a stock price adjusts instantly to new information. In reality, sometimes
incremental
stock price adjusts over some period of time. Might be a week, might be a month. And so a stock going in a certain direction, up or down, may continue to do that for a while. It turns out to be very difficult to assemble a portfolio with the objective of making market-beating returns with momentum. In other words, selling the stocks that have negative momentum and are dropping because they're going to go down further, and buying stocks that are going up because they're going to go up further. People have tried to do that, and it gets to be huge turnover and cost and very difficult. But the factor is there. So what does that mean? And what would it mean in, say, a DFA-style fund, a passive fund, that has many hundreds or thousands of, for example, small value stocks? If a stock is coming down and it's becoming a value stock now because the price is falling, but you can observe the stock has momentum, and there are mathematical models to tell you when a stock has momentum. You're not rushing out to buy and sell things with high turnover and cost. What you're doing is saying, well, here's a stock I would buy because it's fallen into the price range where we think it's attractive. But it's got negative momentum. So we're not going to buy it today. We're going to wait. All you're doing is waiting on the buy until your algorithms tell you the momentum is kind of puttering out. It's probably reached a price where it's not going to continue to decline based on that momentum. So all you do is delay when you buy it until it falls a little further. In the same way, you've got a small value stock in the portfolio and the price is going up. Some good things are happening in the company and the price is going up and it's got momentum. And it's gotten outside the range of value that you have for having a stock in that fund. So if you were an index fund, you would sell it immediately. But what DFA does is incorporates the momentum factor, and the algorithm says, well, okay, it's now too expensive for this portfolio, but it's got upward momentum. So we are going to sell it, but we're not going to rush.
Gotcha.
Take your time, see how far up it goes, and then sell. That turns out to add quite a bit of return to a number of their portfolios that are affected by momentum and where there is the need to trade from time to time.
Is that the factor that lets DFA, when they speak about themselves, often you'll hear that they are passively active? And is that the factor that kind of makes them into that category?
Well, all of these things are activities. These are all active things they do to add value to a portfolio, right? If you start with the S&P 500, and then you add extra value, that's an activity. And if you trade based on trading cost, therefore you're willing to accept some tracking error, you're not going to force a trade and pay up to do it. You're going to be patient and wait and make money on your trades. That's an activity they do every day. If you're going in your trading, you're going to look at momentum before you buy or sell a stock
for the
portfolio. That's also activity. The activity they don't do the reason you'd say passive or maybe smart passive, the smart part is all this other stuff we're talking about. The passive part is they're not trying to pick stocks based on what they think the stock price is going to do. Because they think the market in aggregate is smarter than the individuals who would make those decisions. And on average, active managers picking stocks to try to beat, for example, the S&P 500, most of them fail. Institutionally, it's no longer considered a good idea to be aggressively active in your whole portfolio. That's just been shown to drive up cost, mm-hmm. and not even before cost to beat the market. So passive means we commit to a portfolio of many thousands of stocks around the globe, and we stick with that discipline. And we don't try to time the market. We don't try to get out and raise cash and get back in. And we're not hanging our hats on picking stocks and sectors or anything else. What you try to do is take the things you know you can do well, which is trade intelligently, account for momentum in your trading. Another thing is you look at securities lending activity, and that's where people borrow stocks to short them.
Huh.
So an investment manager lends a stock to somebody who doesn't own it, and he sells it. So he sold a stock he didn't own. Now he's short. If the stock goes down, he gets to buy it back cheaper, give it back to the firm that lent it to him, keep the profit. Conversely, if it goes up and he's short, he's losing money because he's got to buy it back to return it and at a higher price. So you look at securities lending activity, and there's information in there sometimes. You find that stocks, they call it going on special, where everybody wants to borrow the stock, and there's a huge demand for it. The demand is coming from people who are selling it short, and sometimes those people know something bad that hasn't shown up in the price yet, but it's going to soon. And so when you see a stock going special, there's a pretty good chance it's going to go down.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, once again, though, if you actually try to take those signals and create a portfolio to make money from it, it turns out to be impractical. For a variety of reasons, it just doesn't work. But in your trading activity, you can take account of that information and say, well, we own a certain stock. We actually need to buy some more, but it's on special. It looks like there's some probability more than 50% that it's going to go down. Let's not buy it yet. Let's wait. Once again, you're being patient.
Patient. Yeah.
Now, if you were active, you'd sell what you have and you'd bet. If you're patient, you say, I don't have to go buy the rest that I need. I'm not going to sell what I have, but I'm not going to go buy, rush out and buy it. I'm going to wait. And on average, over time, over many thousands of stocks, or hundreds, I'm not sure how many go on special to an extent that creates this kind of trade delay, but it adds value. On average, those stocks do go down. On average, DFA gets to buy them more cheaply than they would have if they pulled the trigger right away. Again, active steps to add incremental value to a disciplined, low-cost, well-diversified portfolio of stocks.
So really, this philosophy could be called intelligent patience.
Yes, it's also called evidence-based investing.
Oh, there's that too. That's probably a better name.
Radical idea. Let's do the things where the evidence firmly supports the quality of the strategy, not the things that are unproven or that have been disproven and people still do it anyway.
Data-driven decisions. It's hard to argue with those.
Yeah. Well, when you have that kind of portfolio, you can have comfort and confidence. You know you're going to get the returns of the market. You're confident that in the long run, you're going to get excess return based on these factors and the trading and momentum. In the short run, you may underperform for some periods of time. But what matters is the prices at which you buy and ultimately the prices at which you sell, and all that fluctuation in between really doesn't matter. When you're committed to a discipline, you know you're going to have lots of fluctuations, but you're not going to worry about that because you can't do anything about it. And if you try to do something about it, you're going to hurt yourself. And we see that happen all the time. So it's fundamentally pretty simple. Technically, of course, it's pretty complicated, and there's calculus involved, but we don't need to understand it at that level to understand why it works so well.
And that's one of the value adds an advisor brings to the relationship.
Right. I would, in fact, much rather take the heat in the short run by telling people things that are important, even if they don't like them, or even if they want to argue with me. This time is different. I'm really upset. Here's why things are going to go so bad or so well. I'm willing to argue and take the short-term conflict of don't bend the ranch because you're happy about what's going on, and don't sell out for cash because you're unhappy about what you're seeing, because you're not really seeing everything, and this is not predictable stuff. There are some things which we understand and we can do, and that's what we've been talking about here. And then there are things like, what are the markets going to do next quarter, next year, that we really can't predict. But if we want long-term successful financial relationships with our clients, we have to tell them the truth, and over time they understand. Well, I argued with them for a while until it turned out that they made sense and this works. So that's our goal in all our relationships with clients. We're kind of far afield from momentum and profitability, but
we have. That's all good, because you know it really boils down for what it means for the end client. You know, take a look at the current moment in time that we're in.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about unpredictability.
Exactly. But if you look at, like, there's a great a chart from Dimensional Fund Advisors in the blog about profitability that talks about the historical observations of 10-year premiums. And I didn't know if you want to just talk to that a little bit.
Again, at the risk of, DFA had a presentation for us one time that was a very powerful visual. And visuals often convey things in a way that work a lot better than words, certainly better than numbers. But it was a big picture of an iceberg, and you can imagine that easily enough. And you're looking at what you see above the water, but when you look at it from the side with sort of a cutaway view of what's under the water, you've got this massive block of ice with just the top sticking up out of the water. And in many ways, our conversations about investments are like that. And we tend to think of three levels. And there's the above the water level, which is simple and conceptual and deals with the basics. And then go underwater, say halfway down, which is starting to get fairly technical. And a lot of what we talked about today is at that second level. And then below that is the third level. And a little bit of what we talked about today is down there. And that's the stuff where people glaze over quickly. They just don't want to hear it. Most people, not all of them. And they don't need to hear it. They don't want to. I don't need to know exactly how the engine of my car works to drive it. Some people love engines. I love driving my car. Back to your question, we're going below the water a little bit here. The factors are called premiums. So if you look at small stocks, look at value measures, look at profitability, over time, what they measure is, for example, if you looked at the S&P 500 and then you took the portion of that that would qualify as value. And over 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, did that value portion outperform the rest of the S&P 500 and outperform the growth part of the S&P 500? So what research has found is that those factors, small size, cheap stocks value, and profitability, all over the long run, have premiums above market returns, and they can measure those premiums. They can also look at the variation in the realization of those premiums, meaning for the last 5 years, what was the value premium? How much more did value stocks earn than growth stocks, than the broad market? And the answer in the last 5 years is they didn't. The last 5 years, growth has outperformed by a lot. The point is that happens. When you look back historically and you break it up into five-year increments and even 10-year increments, then you ask, well, how often does the small cap universe outperform the large cap universe? How often does the value part of the market outperform the growth part? How often does the profitability part outperform the broader market? And you can measure the long-run premiums. Typically, it's 1% or 2% or 3%. It's a lot, but the variation is substantial. But what's also interesting is that you get diversification in the sense that in the last 5 and 10 years, we've actually had small stocks and value stocks underperforming, but profitability is outperformed. So almost never have all the factors underperforming for any period of time, any significant period. And usually you'll have at least two of them outperforming, and net-net the three of them over, you know, average overall outperforming. That's not true at this moment in time. We have a fairly extraordinary circumstance. But profitability of the three factors actually seems to be the most consistent in terms of how frequently it outperforms. It almost always outperforms. And we have lots of data, and we can show you graphs and all of those things too. And we can get into the math. You know,
that's a little too deep.
The simple summary is we got three factors that add value over the long run, and they also add at different times. So having all three is better than having just one. You're less likely to underperform and more likely to outperform, even over shorter periods when you have all three.
So the message here is discipline, patience, stay consistent.
Right. And you've got tilts, meaning modest incremental extra allocations. You know, if you have a small piece of pie instead of half the pie, the small piece is a tilt. Half the pie is well, that's big and getting ready for the slaughter. So we just do the slices. Because you hit bumpy spots and you don't want to have such a big bet that it's so painful that people can't take it. You have to be thoughtful about creating a path you can stick to.
Man, this has been very useful. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I definitely look forward to more conversations about profitability and more about our overall investment philosophy with you and the rest of the investment committee.
This podcast was brought to you by Team Huens, counselors to family wealth. To learn more, please visit teamhuens.com. Thank you.
The content here is for informational purposes only. It should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or used to evaluate any investment or security. This podcast does not constitute a solicitation to enter into an investment agreement with Team Huens. For more details, please visit teamhuens.com/terms of use.